An interview with Lester Paldy, formerly director of continuing education, and now with the Harriman College. And give your background under one a little bit.
Well, I currently serve as professor of technology and society at the College of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and I'm also the director of the Center for Science, Mathematics, and Technology Education. I've been doing that now for the last 4 years.
4 years?
Yes.
Not right.
Yes.
And before that?
Before that, I was an associate professor in the same department in technology and society before, and at the same time served as dean of continuing education for the previous 8 or 9 years, with some time off for service in Washington at the National Science Foundation.
That's it. Okay. And your name?
Is Les Paldy.
Lester?
Lester G. Paldy, yes.
Yes, right.
Yes.
All right. What year did you come to Stony Brook?
I joined the freshman class at Oyster Bay in September of 1958.
58?
Yes.
That's the second year.
Yes, I was in the second year. I was 24 at that time, and had come out of the service, and was very much attracted to the campus because of the environment that I saw there.
Right.
It was just such a complete contrast for me from the laws of Asia.
From where?
Asia. I served in Korea.
You served in Korea?
And I was ready to go to school at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I enlisted in the service when I finished high school, and served for not quite 6 years. Came out of it knowing that I wanted to go to school, and thought that Oyster Bay would be a fine place.
Mm-hmm. Where were you living? I'm here on the...
I lived on campus.
Let's see.
I was born and raised in New York City.
In New York City.
I'd gone to Stuyvesant High School. I studied a lot of mathematics and physics there, and knew I wanted to do something in science, but I had that time-out period for the service. Mm-hmm. So I read in the New York Times somewhere. I think I was home on leave once in 1957, and read in the New York Times that a small college is getting started at Oyster Bay that was going to focus on the training of science teachers, and that was something that I always thought I might like to do. So I came around, perhaps could have been in the summer or fall of 1957, and met Alan Austell, and Austell said, well, when you're ready, come on back. So I applied the following year when I left active duty in May of 1958, right after the Lebanon adventure. I got ready to come to school. Did came in September 1958.
Lebanon adventure.
United States intervened in Lebanon in the spring of 1958.
58. All right.
One of many interventions. That one was relatively painless, however.
But
with the attraction of the physical environment, really, I didn't know a great deal. I mean, I'd never been to college, or I didn't have any other connections with the college of any sort. I really wasn't in a position to make judgments about the quality of the faculty or the curriculum or anything else. But it was the charm of the physical setting that just seemed so attractive to me. I just wanted a place where I could
most unusual
get some solitude and study for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. You have answered three, and you've answered four, I think. You interviewed Austell.
Yes.
Austell interviewed you.
Yeah.
And
it was a very informal talk.
Right.
In retrospect, I think he was interested in getting students who seemed to have their heads screwed on right, and building a school. So.
Right. And you've really answered six, too, I guess. Can you add anything?
I would just
I'm not sure I can add much. I want to stress how much impact the physical setting had on me at the time. So I had no other measures, of course. I didn't talk to many of the faculty, as I recall.
You were 24 then?
I was 24.
Yeah. And you were older than most of the students.
Yes, so I had a war behind me. And,
yeah.
I knew pretty much exactly what I wanted to do, or so I thought at the time. But, okay.
This set of questions is not
getting for the students, obviously. Yeah.
No.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I can tell you some of my other first impressions. I mean, I'm sure I didn't have the faintest notion of what the creative vision was for Stony Brook in 1958, and I had nothing to calibrate it against. But my first impression, as I recall, was the orientation in September of 1958. That introduced me to Sidney Gelber. I was in his orientation.
Go ahead.
And I remember how charmed I was by Sidney. More or less confirmed my desire to come to Stony Brook. And that was a marvelous experience, that introductory period. And there were other people who I met early on, like Merrill Roden, who was a member of the humanities faculty then. He made a great impression on me as a teacher.
What was he like? Because he's, thus far, what I've interviewed, he's a name only.
I see. I think you could probably track him down. I think Leonard Gardner probably knows how to get in touch with Merrill Roden. He's in the Midwest somewhere. In fact, it would be great to get Merrill back for a reunion sometime. In fact, I even offered to someone. I said I would buy him an airplane ticket if they would track him down and invite him. I'm not sure anyone followed through, though. But he was a great teacher. He taught a humanities course, and with a lot of writing. We read all of the obvious great books. I had never heard of the great books program before. I didn't even know I was in it. All I knew was that I was reading Thucydides and Herodotus, and finding it fascinating. And Merrill was infinitely patient at correcting people's writing and working with them to develop the insights that were needed. So he was a great teacher. And so I would say Merrill Roden made an enormous impression on me at the time, as did Cliff Swartz in physics at the same time. I was working in the Natural Science 1 course with Cliff and Francis Bonner and others, and more or less reinforced my desire to study physics. It just was a great experience all around.
You graduated in 61?
62.
You graduated
yes.
In 62?
May of 62.
So you saw evolution toward
research and
departmentally oriented, isn't it?
Yes. I'm not sure I could have articulated it clearly at the time. In retrospect, it's very clear what was happening. And as far as I was concerned, that had no negative impact on us at all. We still had small classes. We still had, for the most part, people who were good teachers. So the coming emphasis on specialization, departmentalization, and research really didn't affect us very much at all. We were fortunate we had people who were very good physicists, for example, in my own group. But in small classes, I had Leonard Eisenbutt for three or four of my courses, I think. And having a class of four or five or perhaps 10 people with someone of Leonard's quality was just a remarkable experience.
Yeah.
So we benefited both ways, I think, from the small classes and from the quality of faculty. We were attracted because they thought that they were going to be building another school later.
To what extent were you involved emotionally or intellectually in the gradual split?
Well, we saw it happening. I didn't fully appreciate it at the time. I remember feeling, well, I was mainly interested in absorbing as much information as I could. So I was only peripherally connected with campus politics. There were some students who were much more politically active than I was.
Who were some of them?
Oh, people like Mary Lou Lyonels.
How do you spell her name?
Mary Lou Lyonels. I believe it's L-I-O-N-E-L-S. Rosemary Capone. These were people who were very close with Alan Ostrow and some of the others, and they got emotionally caught up with it all. I can remember that.
Do you remember Judy Shep?
Yes, I remember Judy, sure. She was also active, politically active. I remember the, 61, when the there was a study stoppage or a student strike of some sort. I didn't have much patience for that. I felt they need not go to class if they didn't want to, of course, but I did. It had nothing to do with my feelings about Alan Ostrow or the way he was being treated, or Leonard Olson, or anybody else. It was just that I was tremendously pressured with trying to learn all this information.
Right.
Kept on studying. I was not unsympathetic, as I recall. Alan Ostrow was a superb administrator. You could always go in and talk to him at any time. Very accessible and thoughtful. We have a very high regard for Alan. I never knew Leonard Olson, really. Leonard was a much more distant figure to me, at least. And so I really don't have any feeling for the measure of the man or the nature of his contributions.
Do you have any feeling for Lee?
No, none whatsoever. I think if I met him once or heard him speak once at some larger session, that might have been it. But I have no feelings one way or the other about it.
All right. You were gone before I got there. I came in September of 62.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
When did you come back to the campus? I rejoined the faculty in 1967. I started as I guess I was a part-time instructor in the Department of Physics, working with Cliff Swartz. I came back, Bentley Glass really arranged it, I guess. Bentley was starting a school of continuing education, and he had envisioned creating teams of people with school experience, which I had by then, and faculty who would work on the development of refresher programs and re-education programs for teachers in particular, but others as well. So he thought I would be a good person to work with Cliff, so he invited me to come back, and I did. And
how did he know about you?
Well, I had been teaching. I kept up my connections with the Department of Physics. I had been teaching high school physics at Cold Spring Harbor, which was close enough to the bio labs. I think we had some peripheral contacts there when Bentley was coming through the bio lab or something, and I knew the people at the bio lab quite well. Most of their children were my students. And I had always made it a point to bring my students out to Stony Brook, the physics club we had, three or four times a semester, perhaps. So I was still pretty well integrated into the physics department. And I must have looked like a reasonable candidate when they were looking for someone with school experience to come back and work with Cliff and with Bentley.
Did you ever have any connection with the principal, Francis?
Roberts, oh sure. Roberts was the principal at Cold Spring Harbor High School who hired me when I started there.
I see.
And, of course, then later he was to come out to the Three Village School District.
I was on the search committee.
I see.
And I was the one that put him in to the last six to be interviewed, even though he was no superintendent.
I see. Well, he was a superb person. I still see him socially, and very gifted.
Well, he's back there now, isn't he?
He's back. He's superintendent of Cold Spring, at the whole Cold Spring Harbor System. He made the usual odyssey from Laurel Island up to Yale for a while, then down to the National Endowment for the Humanities for a couple of years, and then back as superintendent.
And Bentley's writing a history of Cold Spring Harbor.
The BioLab, yes, I know. Yes. So I have benefited enormously from my contact with the university over the years and the people I've met. The Oyster Bay period was a very rich period in my life. I'm most grateful. But the faculty are now beginning to retire in significant numbers, so it will be probably within the next, I think, 5 to 10 years, I would imagine most of them will have been retired, except for the very youngest at the time.
Right.
Those would be people like Ted Goldfarb and Bob Schneider.
Yeah. right now, I'm interested in what you can describe of the period when you first rejoined the faculty in 67 on to, let's say, 78 or something of that sort. Quality of student life, quality of faculty life and relations, student-faculty relations, the projection of the purposes of the institution, how well they were understood locally, and if you have any connections with Albany, that kind of thing. In other words, if you were going to write a history of Stony Brook, what would you do?
Well, taking the last question first, that's easiest, was I really never had any connection with Albany, with that part of the apparatus at all. I may have had an occasional letter to the State Education Department, but I had virtually no contact with SUNY. I think that I would have been hard-pressed to identify any of the senior officers of the SUNY Central Administration. I think they just weren't in my orbit. The when I joined the faculty in 1967, it was a very freewheeling place. You could do anything, really. If you had an idea, you were given a free rein. Johnny always went out of his way to be helpful if I needed help from him. Alec Pond, all of them were eager to build the place up, and they turned me loose on it. And I don't recall them ever telling me I couldn't try something. And that was all I asked for. I just really liked the free reign and the enormous atmosphere. We were not, I mean, I was aware of the problems that the campus faced in terms of construction, lack of cohesion, and all of those things. But as an individual faculty member, just trying to get started with a faculty career, really, that didn't bother me at all. It was all a lot of fun. We were out hustling for grant funds from NSF and trying to build programs and teach, develop new courses. So it was all a lot of fun. I never had any...
Your connection was with engineering or with physics?
With physics at the time.
With physics at the time.
Yes. And but I was heavily involved in, I wasn't doing research physics, I was helping to develop these programs that Bentley brought me out to develop in the Center for Continuing Education with physics contributions. So the CED program was virtually incoherent at the time. It was a nightmarish thing with no real effort to control the quality of the experience, whether administrative or academic. By the way, it was quite common for a registration session to consist of having 2,000 or 3,000 people milling around in the floor of the gymnasium. The academic part wasn't much better. There were classes that were being taught by TAs and with very little faculty input. They were trying to build it. People came flocking in because it was the first program of its type, and the administration really hadn't paid enough attention to getting it in good order.
Who was heading it up then?
Well, the first director of CED was Charlie Wolcott. Charlie put up with it for about a year or so and then went back to biology and left it. And then they had a succession of other directors, and the administration wasn't paying enough attention to it. The thing was going downhill very fast. They had many thousands of students, but the quality of the experience was very uneven. If you happen to find yourself with a good teacher, for example, a good faculty member who took it seriously, you can have a terrific experience in CED, but those were improbable, I think. There are many of the courses were taught poorly. So that, trying to get that and make some sense out of that, trying to do a good job with our part of it, at least really occupied most of my time.
And it was from there that you gradually became, or were finally selected to
Well, I'd served on a number of committees, and I complained once too often, I guess. And
well, you do it, huh?
They essentially said, now it's your turn, Buster.
Right.
So I tried it for a while.
Well, I was a section hand under Bentley for at least 1 year, and maybe possibly two, in his Science and the Nature of Man course. And I also was a section hand for Tom Altizer in one of his courses for a year.
Well, that's what I mean. One could have a terrific experience with some like Bentley or Tom Altizer, I suspect, or yourself, although I didn't know you as a teacher at the time. But there were other courses that really had, it seemed to me, to lack academic coherence, had no substance. But that was probably just grew too fast. It was they tried to do too much with it without putting in the proper control system.
I was certainly disappointed with the quality of the teachers that I had. Some of them were all right, but I would say that 40-50% of them could hardly write a decent sentence. Mm-hmm. All right. Well,
the faculty morale in those days, of course, the war was upon us by then, and that influenced things a great deal. But in some ways, the sense of community was much with us at the time. I recall having, I don't know what year it was now, probably in 68 or thereabouts, or 69, with essentially a large communal faculty meeting in the gymnasium where the administration addressed the faculty as a whole, really, or as many as could pack in to the gymnasium. I don't think the university senate was organized in quite the same way as it is now. It was much more spread. System may have been, I don't recall exactly, but it could be that every faculty member had one vote and people voted community meetings of that sort. So that was all exciting at the time, and you had a sense of being very much part of the society in which we lived, subject to all of the tides of emotion and all of the currents that ran through it at the time.
You were there at the time of the invasion of the campus by Suffolk police.
Yes, I never paid much attention to that. I thought it was all foolishness, and figured that it would go away. Of course, it gave us a reputation that was rather undeserved, I'm afraid, but just showed characteristic poor judgment on the part of county authorities, it seems to me.
Well, there were political motives behind it.
I'm sure. I never felt that drug usage or anything like that was more prevalent on this campus than it was anywhere else in society, as far as I could see. Although, since I wasn't a user, it was hard for me to make. I have no data to support that. But
I remember this was before Johnny came, that we had one problem that brought us into connection with the police. Chap in our grounds burned a little shack here on campus, and when I went over to Hot Park at the time, standing around, and we were talking about drugs, and I said that as far as I knew, we didn't have any problem at that point. He said, well, it's coming out the island. It's in the high schools, and you'll have it pretty soon. He was on the narcotics squad.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure he was right. I have been told by students at the time that it was easy to purchase drugs of various kinds. There were dealers there in the dormitories who would sell things to you if you wondered about it. But then why would that surprise me? Why would it be different? We have, in effect, a small town out here with 15 or 16,000 people coming through it. Why would one expect it to be different? Particularly given our proximity to New York City and the culture.
All right.
I guess I would notice it occasionally. There would be students, an occasional student in class who didn't seem really with it at all. Then one would speculate about whether the drugs had anything to do with it. But, we rarely inquired further.
All right. Well, now let's see. I think a general question is about the extent to which your own career has developed here on the campus to your satisfaction, or have there been problems with it? You've gone off. How far away from the original point of your compass have you gone? Mm-hmm. Have you stayed with it pretty well?
I think I've stayed with it pretty well. I found my work here at Stony Brook to be enormously satisfying, and I have no serious complaints about the amount of... I've always been given a tremendous amount of freedom, and that to me is exceptionally important. Freedom to make mistakes, I've made a fair number, but if I've had ideas, I've been given a free hand, and that to me is what a university is all about. So I've broadened my interest, I think. I started out with a rather specialized interest in the teaching of physics for the last 15 years or so. I've been involved in arms control issues of one kind or another. I've spent several tours in Washington with the National Science Foundation, getting involved with public policy formulation in a variety of ways. And that's been very satisfying to me, not unrelated to what I do. The combination of work in Washington and at Stony Brook has been very, very helpful for me.
National Science Foundation, public policy. To what extent have they been involved in it?
Well, formulating public policy for science and engineering education in the United States, they have a primary responsibility via the National Science Board. Its committees, for example. They essentially formulate policy for the foundation, and then the foundation carries it out, subject to the political dictates of the current administration.
Was Leda Bridge involved at the time you were there?
No. By that time, I think he'd retired. I never knew De Bridge. I seen his picture in the wardroom, of course, but I never had the pleasure of meeting him. We've had a number of people at Stony Brook working with the National Science Foundation in one capacity or another, whether as visiting scholars, in effect, which I was, rotating personnel, where people go and spend several years at the foundation and then come back.
Who were some of them?
Well, Arnold Strassenberg, for example, who's there now.
All right.
Yes, he's finishing a 3-year tour. Arnold Feingold from physics.
Right.
Spent some time there. Bob McGrath in physics, John Thorpe in mathematics, who's now left the campus, I guess. But we've had a number over the years, and of course, many of our faculty serve on review committees and do the usual things that researchers do in connection with foundation work. But I spent two tours there, 1972-73, and then again in 83-84.
Leland Hayworth, was he gone by then?
He was also gone by then, yes. And, so for me, the combination of opportunities to serve in Washington and here at Stony Brook have been remarkable. I think they just fit my own interests so precisely. Had I been dealing the cards, I couldn't have dealt them any better myself.
Good. Well, that's good. What do you think is the future of Harriman College?
I'm not sure I can really give you any deep insight into Harriman. I know the current dean somewhat. My son finished a degree at Harriman just this past June. And while my son was there, I made it a point not to get too closely involved with the college. I'm in the same building, in effect, but I didn't want to insert myself in that loop as long as my son was around. So I really don't have any deep insights. I'm sure it's needed. I think that the interest in management and business will not go away, and we ought to have as good a school as we can. Whether it should be deflected from its original public sector focus is a matter on which I'm not really qualified, I think, to comment. I don't have any deep insight into the strategy for the development of a management school.
Who's the dean now?
Garrett Wolf. Yes. Harry Weiner was the previous dean, and Harry's still around. I'm sure Harry, so you can probably have some fun by talking with Harry and with Garrett and some of the others. Seriatim, I suspect, not another group. But for me, it's been exceptionally, it's been a wonderful opportunity because I've come back and had the privilege of serving as a colleague with people who were my teachers in many instances, and of course you see them in different lights, but satisfying, it gives my professional life a certain coherence and wholeness and sense of continuity that I think I'm fortunate to have.
You grow up to ultimately to become an equal and be accepted as an equal to your professors. Although you were older, I remember that transition in my own case, where my mentor was Crane Brinton at Harvard, and I assisted him the next year. And he was a senior tutor, a society fellow, senior fellow. And I remember coming back to some of the dinners, no longer a student, the same basis. Well, now let's see if there's anything else. Is there anything else that I ought to? What do you feel you have accomplished in particular in the development of the institution?
I invest a lot of effort in my teaching, and I find that very satisfying. I think students respond appropriately, and I think I've worked with a group of students over the years who've gone on to do important things in their own life, in their own rights. That's probably...
That's a good test of a teacher.
I suppose it's a good test.
The best teacher.
Yeah, that's a good test. So I think that's probably one of my most important accomplishments, really. I've labored, like others, trying to contribute to the administrative efforts around here, improving CED, trying to make that a more coherent, satisfying experience for students and for faculty, with mixed results. I mentioned there. When I left, I saw lots of things that I hadn't managed to do anything about, despite effort. On the other hand, I saw some signs of progress, too. So that those two things, I think, been a lot of fun. And I continue to learn a great deal from the people with whom I've worked. That's important to me. Managed to do a few things in Washington, I think, that had some sticking power.
Can you be specific?
Well, we helped. I wrote a set of a policy analysis that led to the, what you might call the institutionalization of a particular NSF program activity that has now become an accepted way of doing business, a program that required universities that were seeking NSF support to improve school programs to develop collaborative relationships with the schools rather than just sitting off and dispensing manna from on high. So I think that that was satisfying to me to have that impact. And since then, I've more recently had a chance to write about the necessary connection between NSF research programs and its education programs. And I think that's been received, not unanimously by the people down there, but by the director of the National Science Foundation has told me that he was going to try to implement some of those ideas in NSF policy in the future. That kind of thing is rewarding. So if you think that you can influence the federal mammoth to take a small step in a meandering direction for a change. So that was fun. And, you know, I've edited a journal for the last 10 years, Journal of College Science Teaching, and we've had a lot of fun.
What kind of science teaching?
College science teaching. Yes. It's a journal devoted primarily to undergraduate instruction in the sciences.
I see.
With articles written by people talking about new courses, new curricula, new formulations of general education programs, and the like. So that's been a lot of fun.
Cliff Schwartz got the Ørsted Medal.
Cliff got the Ørsted Medal from AAPT a few years back for distinguished contributions to the teaching of physics. We have a remarkable collection of women here in science education, really. Of course, Bentley, John Truxell, Arnold Strassenberg, Cliff Schwartz, mm-hmm. even Frances Bonner had a hand in the chemical education activity of the early 1960s,
Frank Erk,
that makes it very satisfying to do what we now do, because we have people we can talk to about important issues when they come up and get good advice.
Well, that is off campus. That isn't, it doesn't relate to Albany, but it's off campus and it's discipline wide.
Mm-hmm.
And it's
impact. Mm-hmm.
Very good.
It spins off onto the campus often because, you would see, for example, now this semester, Cliff Schwartz is working on a somewhat different approach to the teaching of freshman physics in terms of the way the course is organized, with tutorials, in effect, replacing some of the larger sessions.
Mm-hmm.
Continuous creative effort on his part now for nearly 30 years, more than 30 years. Fun to watch.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
All right. 15. Can you name individuals who did things that were important for the future development of the university?
Well, there are so many.
John Toll, for instance.
Oh, sure. Well, all of the senior administration that made important contributions were rather different. Different substance, different style, but all important, ranging from Johnny, Alec, Sidney, Bentley. Those were all important years. Bob Marcus in undergraduate studies.
Yeah. Is he at Brockport now?
I believe he's provost at Brockport.
Yes,
I believe so. Herb Weisinger back in the graduate school. Herb was a difficult guy to get along with. I didn't have any trouble getting along with him, but other people did. But Herb was tough, and he had high standards. You had to cut it to get by Herb. Mm-hmm. And he could be arbitrary, but basically he's a thoughtful, insightful man.
Okay, I interviewed him down in Florida.
I noticed there with...
Well, I think that's about
okay.
Everything I can.
All right. I think I've told you. I've given you the high points anyway.
All right.
So I'll have to look through my files and see if I have any memorabilia that would be appropriate for the archive.
All right. By all means, do that. Yeah. You know, Falkers.
Oh yes, sure.
By all means.
Just give it to him if I think it's over.
Absolutely. He's understaffed, but...
For example, I know I have a set of physics notebooks, my physics notes from those years, 4 years worth of hardbound physics notebooks.
I see.
No idea if you want them. I'll let him know sometime.
Good.
I know what happens with things like that. Sooner or later, you look at them and say, why do I need these? And you throw them out.
Well, the reason I'm doing this is that they had an idea about 3 or 4 years ago, I think Homer Neal started it, that they wanted a history of Stony Brook. And they talked to a number of people about writing it.
Well, I think it's well worthwhile.
I think so too. But and I had volunteered to be helpful for the years that I was head of the institution, president without the title. On my own, I checked to see whether Judge Sullivan's papers, he had died, were still around. I checked with his second wife, and she wrote back saying that they had thrown his papers out in the home, and the secretary said that they were nowhere to be found in his chambers. So I simply sent that to Jerry Schubel, with a comment, also calling attention to the fact that the three governors who were responsible for starting the university system and Stony Brook were all dead. That Tom Hamilton was dead. He was called president then, but he was the chancellor of Harvard.
He was dead.
That our dean, Dan Ross, was dead. Chairman of the Board of Trustees, Frank Moore, who had been the right-hand man of Dewey, and also of Rockefeller, was dead. And that if they wanted to get some insight into the paper that would still be available, the documents, from people who actually lived and worked, better get started getting some recollections down. I think that's what started it.
Mm-hmm.
So I've done over 60. I think you're 61 or 2
mm-hmm.
at this point. But I'm working on a book on human valuation. That's what I'm interested in.
Dean for nearly 10 years, and not one of the deans with real authority and real resources at my disposal. I was just astonished that we didn't put more responsibility on the deans and give them more authority and say, I don't care how you do it, just do it right.
We've always, even though we probably claim that we're much more decentralized now, it seems to me the deans are not given enough responsibility.
Right. That's something that I've felt very strongly.
The dean service messengers from the provost to the departments.
That's all they do.
They're messengers. They're bearers of bad or good news.
And the provost is in no position, really, to know the details of personnel management. Faculty, let's say the care and feeding of faculty.
In general,
they don't know.
That's correct.
And the department chairman, it's up to the department chairman to do a good job, and you are at the mercy of the kind of people that come up and are and become chairman. I have no idea how that works. Nobody's talked about that.
It's very uneven. I think recently I've seen some stirrings. I think that there have been a couple of retreats where they've gathered department chairs and brought them out to Montauk or someplace and tried to spend a weekend with them talking about what it means to be a good department chairman and what the responsibilities are.
Who did that, Jerry?
I assume so. It was under his watch, so I assume Jerry was in some sense responsible for it. But that's badly needed. It's always been astonishing that here management, after all, is a reasonably well-evolved discipline in the United States, yet universities, at least this university, one with which I've had both experience, seem to pay absolutely no attention to any of the lessons learned, and that people are appointed to be as chairman because they're fine scholars, and they may not have the faintest idea of how to elicit the real human potential of the people in their groups.
Absolutely. Right. That's That's the function, I think, of a dean, is to facilitate the intellectual growth and watch out for the behavior of faculty members vis-a-vis students and vis-a-vis colleagues. Mm-hmm. One of the statements about the nature of a dean, or the function of a dean, is that he's supposed to comfort the afflicted students and afflict the comfortable professors.
Well, that's been a long-standing problem around here. It could be that they're making some inroads now,
I see.
But I'm not sure. I'm not close enough to it.
Right.
But that's been a problem.
Well, Alec made an excellent department chairman.
Oh, he was? No question.
One reason I selected Stan Ross was that I liked the way he went at the selection of new staff, care with which he looked at new staff. But I didn't know him well enough to know some of the other aspects at the time. But I needed a dean. I came as acting chief administrative officer and dean of arts and sciences. The whole work.
Well, one of the problems now is that the provost has to, in effect, serve as dean of arts and sciences. And he does that, and I've seen this. I've worked for three provosts, and it seems to me that's done at great cost, because you then neglect relations with the Health Sciences Center, mm-hmm. and you're too much involved.